Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Well, you know, one thing that no one can ever accuse us of?
What's that?
Conduct unbecoming.
Probably not.
We're just straight up dudes that, you know, mind our own business and go through life and share joy wherever there's a listener.
That's true.
Or whatever.
Well,
but that's not the way for everybody.
That's true. And sometimes their feet are held to the fire because of contracts.
Well, their feet are held to the fire and there may be hands involved in some of them. You never know. Let your fingers do the walking.
Well, on our Facebook court appointed page, Heather Fucasey.
Glad you had to say that. I didn't know if that was a long U or a short U.
It's spelled F-U-K-A-S-E, and I had nightmares about having to pronounce that.
Fucase.
Fucase. suggested that we should talk about morality clauses in contracts.
Let's just say Heather.
Heather. Heather said we should talk about morality clauses in contracts. And so we thought that would be kind of an interesting, fun topic to talk about.
And not only that, it's topical right now with Robert Kraft. The owner of the New England Patriots, the world champion New England Patriots. And he got caught with his hand in the cookie jar?
I don't think it was his hand.
Well, I guess he got his happy ending turned into a sad ending.
Yeah. I saw a cartoon today. It said something about a team could beat the Patriots one-handed.
Like, or at least the owner.
Ooh. So morality clause is basically a term in a contract that attempts to make sure that someone acts or refrains from acting in a certain way. Usually you see this kind of clause in a contract with a famous athlete or an actor or an actress or maybe a CEO of a large corporation, or in this case, NFL owners.
That's right.
Really, the purpose of a morality clause is to kind of safeguard the image or the brand of something and make sure it's kept in the appropriate positive light. Because, well, obviously the NFL needs to be kept in the proper, appropriate light.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that owners were included in that. It used to be that the contracts just went down to the individual players, and they signed that as part of their individual contracts. And then in 2014, the NFL came out with a standard conduct code for all employees of the NFL.
Yeah. And I didn't actually know about that. You brought that to my attention.
Yeah, it said the NFL teams unanimously endorsed a revised and strengthened personal conduct policy for all NFL employees, and it was presented at a meeting in Dallas. This will better enable us to make appropriate decisions and ensure accountability for everyone involved in the process. And it says that the new policy lays out clear steps to be taken when there's an incident that requires review. And the new measures include NFL-funded counseling and service for victims, families, and violators, a more extensive list of prohibited conduct, and independent investigation procedures. It said the policy states it is a privilege to be a part of the National Football League. Everyone who is part of the league must refrain from conduct detrimental to the integrity of and public confidence in the NFL. This includes owners, coaches, players, other team employees, game officials, and employees of the league office, NFL Films, NFL Network, or any other NFL business.
Including water boys.
That's right. Including water. If you're affiliated with it, if you're part of the team, if you get a paycheck from it in some manner, you fall under this policy. So until then, owners weren't in that. But in 2014, they added them in. And unfortunately for Mr. Kraft, that's brought him into a little trouble.
I think it has. I don't think there's been any update about what's happening with that case. I think they're probably still investigating it to a certain degree, but I imagine the NFL brass is going to come down pretty heavy-handed on him.
Well, they've got to a certain extent, if they've done something like that with players.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I got that heavy-handed. I think it was more light touch, though, that he was interested in.
Or maybe a subtle mixture of both.
You never know. But, you know, he's saying, here's the thing with me is there, the cop down there, the head guy with this sting operation, he said, we've got videos of everyone that's been charged. You know, he didn't say, we believe this happened. We've got videos of everyone that would be charged on every incident.
Yikes.
Now, if I'm Bob Kraft, I'm not going to say, I didn't do it and stand up and defiantly, I didn't do it and this isn't right. I don't want that tape to show up. I think this is where a good Kennedy plea comes in. You plead no contest and say, go ahead, because they're not going to put him in jail. You know, they might fine him, but he's a billionaire. Who cares? You know, pay the fine and move on. But you do not want that video to surface.
Yeah. I think probably the actual crime itself seems pretty innocuous, but I guess the bigger concerns is this part of some sort of larger sex trafficking type situation. Yeah. And sheds light on that, which, you know, that could be a possibility. And that's,
well,
you
know, that's true. That's exactly what you say, because, you know, we had the episode before where we talked about prostitution, and we really talked about it's a victimless crime. And that if it was legalized and done properly, licensed and taxed and everything else, it would be much safer. It would take it out of the hands of you know,
criminal element.
Yeah, organized crime and all that. It would be safer for the girls. Hell, they could get health insurance, you know. They could form a union and, you know, stand hand in hand. But what they said is these girls were being brought over from China in this group of massage parlors that were being run. And they were being brought over under false pretenses about jobs and visas and everything else. And then they were putting them in these places and telling them, this is what you'll do, or we'll turn you over to immigration.
Yeah.
You know, so they were put in a spot where they were basically being kidnapped.
Pretty much, yeah.
And that was all part of it. And that's why this was so bad. It's not just, you know, a mere prostitution thing.
And I doubt Bob Kraft had any idea that was going on, you know.
Well, that's true. I don't know. I've never been in those kind of places, so I don't know, you know, how that would work. But, I don't know what kind of indications would you get.
Yeah. And, I mean, there's probably going to be a language barrier there.
Yeah. They probably don't speak English, at least not verbally.
Yeah. I don't even know what that means. You're perverting my young mind.
Well, I'm thinking of the language of love.
Oh.
The language of love is universal. It doesn't need words.
I would think your average person off the street wouldn't know that that's kind of what's going on there. But, I mean, that is a real major concern about these kinds of places.
I just know I wouldn't want my 77-year-old wrinkled old body parts being shown on a videotape for the world to see. I'd just say, how much do I owe you?
Yeah.
We're moving along.
I'm paying my fine.
Yeah.
Let's move along here. Now, morality clause, I mean, the NFL is more of a policy. It's not really a contract, but it's kind of very similar in that it's legislating or basing it off different kinds of morals that you need to adhere to. Now, the beginning of morality clauses dates back, according to some articles I read, to about 1921. Mm-hmm. So it's the Roaring Twenties. There was a gentleman by the name of Roscoe Conkling Fatty Arbuckle.
Very popular comedian.
He was.
Old Fatty.
Yep.
Now his name would be politically incorrect. You couldn't call somebody Fatty Arbuckle.
He was a popular actor and comedian, and that was during the silent film era. And he was, I guess, pretty busy. I guess he's starting a lot of movies. I don't know. I've never seen any of them. But
Well, no wonder they were in the 20s.
That's true. And actually, I read somewhere that there's not much footage of them left because of the fallout from what took place. But he took a break from his busy film schedule in September of 1921, which if I was thinking about this, that's like almost 100 years ago that this took place.
Yeah.
Which if you put it into context, back in 1921, 100 years from there would have been 1821. And that's really long time ago.
Well, that's 200 years.
I know.
That's true. 200 is more than 100.
I know. But think about that. Like, and putting in the context, if we look back now, I mean, it seems really far, far away, but it's really not.
It's not?
I don't know.
I think it is. It was before me, and I've been around forever.
That's true. You are old as dirt.
I knew God when he was a boy.
So I'll stop being conceptual about this time thing now. So anyway, in September 1921, he took a break from shooting his busy film schedule, and he decided to have a hotel party, like all classic, you know, silent film era stars did back then, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I guess you didn't have to worry about him making any noise anyway.
That's true. That's true. There's actually, I saw a picture of the post-party hotel room. Everything was like smashed and torn up. Looks like they had a really good time.
I wonder if the Three Stooges were there.
Probably. But anyway, there was a woman there by the name of Virginia Rapp, and she passed away a couple days after the party. And what had come to light is that she had been at the party, and they had been like drinking and carrying on, things like that, and that she had taken ill and gotten sick, and then basically, I guess they called like the hotel doctor to the room, which I guess back then they had hotel doctors.
Okay.
And they administered morphine to her because they thought she was just, you know, having some normal 1920s issues, I guess.
And morphine was a regular 1920s drug.
I guess. And so they took her home, and then 2 days later she passed away. She died. And her friend, a lady by the name of Bambina Maud Delmont, told the doctor 2 days later when she was at the hospital that Fatty Arbuckle had raped her friend Virginia, and that the weight of him weighing on top of her was what probably ruptured her bladder. So I guess
Fatty wasn't just a nickname. He was really a fatty.
Yeah, I think he gets his name honestly.
Oh, okay.
So I guess Virginia must have been unconscious pretty much the whole time, because there's no allegations in the story that she said that this guy did this to her. It's just her friend, Bambina Maud Delmont, said this.
Okay.
So it's kind of very strange. Well, anyway, they arrested him a few days later in September, and then it went to trial in November 1921. So, like, really quickly thereafter. I mean, talk about swift justice. That's like, you know, bam, bam.
Yeah, it's not like nowadays.
Yeah, so.
You wait 10 years before you ever go to trial.
So he had three different trials. The first one I talked about in November 1921 was a hung jury. It was 10 to acquit, 2 for guilty. There was another hung jury in 1922. And then in March 13th, 1922, the next year, Arbuckle was actually formally acquitted. All the jurors voted to acquit him. And this is kind of strange. The jurors, prior to issuing the acquittal, gave an apology, and they said, "Acquittal is not enough for Roscoe Arbuckle. We feel that a great injustice has been done to him. There was not the slightest proof adduced to connect him in any way to the commission of the crime." So basically, it's kind of strange, but, you know, they actually issued an apology.
So they just had the word of one woman, and did she say she was in the room or and observed that, or that her friend told her that?
No, that she was there and saw it.
She was there and saw it.
But there were other people there, I guess, that didn't see it. Hmm. So.
So this was a public display of affection going on, or is that what we're saying?
Yeah, I don't know. So, but the problem was is that his reputation and career were basically ruined because of all this.
Right.
Because in the public eye, he was, you know, he was a rapist and a bad person and all this. So,
and a bad lovemaker at that.
Well, I don't think there was any evidence that she'd had sex, actually. It was part of the problem too.
Oh.
Because they did an autopsy. Hmm. And then here's the other thing. After reading the formal apology, the jury foreman personally handed the statement to Arbuckle, and he kept it as a treasured memento for the rest of his life. And then,
even though his career was ruined.
Yeah. And then one by one, the entire 12-person jury, plus the two jury alternates, walked up to Arbuckle's defense table, where they shook hands and embraced him and personally apologized to him. The entire jury even proudly posed in a photo op with Arbuckle for photographs after the verdict and apology.
Wow.
I mean, whoever that lawyer was, that's about, you don't get much better than that. Like, yeah. Not only is your guy found not guilty,
he's acquitted to
him. And he apologized.
And that's after two other trials that were hung on whether he was guilty or not.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, some of the experts later concluded that her bladder may have been ruptured as a result of an abortion she might have had prior to that, when it was kind of a taboo type thing and done under the table.
There was a lot of maybe this and maybe that, because they didn't have the science to actually.
Exactly. And also, there was a lot of alcohol consumed at the party, so he was actually forced to plead guilty to one count of violating the Volstead Act, which is the Prohibition Act, and he had to pay a $500 fine. So basically, though, here's the real kicker. At the time of his acquittal after that third trial, he owed over $700,000, that's approximately $10.5 million in 2018 money, in legal fees to his attorneys for the three criminal trials, and was forced to sell his house and all of his cars to pay off some of the debt.
And he died destitute and broke, probably.
No, there's more to it.
Oh, yeah?
So he had a tough time. He kind of
went into porn after that?
I don't think so. Hear that old stand-up comedian joke talk about porno music, and it's like, boom, chicka, boom, boom,
wow, chicka, wow, wow.
Wonder what the porn music was like in the silent film era. Maybe there just wasn't any.
It was silent.
Yeah. Or you think there's somebody playing an organ? There's somebody playing
an organ. Yeah, there was somebody playing an organ.
That's not even what I meant.
It's porn. There had to be an organ in play somewhere.
So anyway, he after this, he had kind of a tough time. He bounced around, had a couple of divorces, and made a few movies here and there. But they weren't really released very widely because of the scandal. A lot of people didn't want him associated with it at all.
Well, yeah, in those days, the actors were like under contract with the studios. So they like belonged to that studio. It's not like now where actors can go make movies for anybody they want to.
That's true.
So when they went down, they took the studio down with them.
So in June of 1933, he had just filmed two movies. So his career looked like it was on a bit of an upswing. And he signed a contract with Warner Brothers to star in a feature-length film. That night, he went out with some friends to celebrate on June 28th, 1933. And he actually had just been married again, too. It was his first wedding anniversary. And he had the new contract, and he reportedly said, "This is the best day of my life."
And he died in a car wreck.
That night, he suffered a heart attack and died in his sleep. Since the tragic tale of
Fatty Arbuckle.
This really wasn't an episode about Fatty Arbuckle, but it was just too interesting, this story, to not go into a little
bit. Well, but you're right. All the research, when I researched this topic, everything pointed to that case is what started these morality clauses in contracts. That until that, it was not a thing. And that was what happened after this, because all the studios wanted to protect themselves. And that's where they first started popping up, was in the entertainment industry.
Absolutely.
And then it spread from there, because I'm sure that there were other incidents came up, said, "Hey, that's just like what they have. We better get these clauses in here."
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to talk about the first actual morality clause that came into play in the 1920s. But first, I think we have a couple motions.
Why, yes, we do. We have a motion and a summons. The first motion is we would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right. Who's on the docket?
Our good friends at Robinhood.
Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free.
Free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits.
Plus, there is no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level.
The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike.
View easy-to-understand charts and market data and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone.
You can also view stock collections, such as 100 most popular.
Now, with Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest.
Robinhood is giving listeners of Court Appointed a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Just sign up at court.robinhood.com.
That's court.robinhood.com.
Happy trading. Now, for the first time ever, we have a summons to the court.
That's right. We were summoned.
Well, there's some acquaintances of ours, Sonia and Jesse, that have developed a game that is based on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's called Supreme Courtship. And it's kind of like, if you're, maybe similar to Ace Attorney, the Nintendo game, where you get to be an attorney and have different sagas you have to kind of go through. It's kind of similar to that, from my understanding of it.
But anyway, they're the experts on it, so we thought we'd have them join us today and tell us about it and tell us how you might be able to get in on the ground floor. So, Jesse and Sonia, take it away.
Thanks, guys. We're really excited to be on the show. Now, we're not lawyers, but learning about politics and legal issues in our country has always been something we're interested in, which is why we love shows like this. And we want to help bring even more people into the wild world of American legalese.
That's right, Jesse. And where better to start than with the U.S. Supreme Court? Did you know that a majority of Americans can't name all the justices? Some people even think Judge Judy sits on the highest court of our nation.
I mean, she's certainly put in the hours. Joking aside, getting people to learn about the third branch of government is a real hurdle in civics education. Justices on the Supreme Court serve for a lifetime, and yet few people know who they are, what they do, or anything about the cases they decide on.
So, being game developers, we asked ourselves, how can we help solve this problem? What can we do to make the Supreme Court, well, fun?
After years of working hard and talking to people, legal experts and non-experts alike, we've finally come out with a project to help teach people about the judicial branch. And that project is Supreme Courtship.
Supreme Courtship is a comedy-adventure video game about the U.S. Supreme Court, where players learn about the judicial branch through first-hand experience. That's right, you get to play as the fictional newly appointed Ninth Justice on the court. Grab a gavel and step into your robes as you make decisions on monumental court cases, mingle with the other justices to learn about their views and history, and see the political and social impact of your role on American society.
By making a fun, lighthearted game about the American judiciary, we hope to make the Supreme Court accessible and exciting in a way it's never been depicted before, and help players develop informed opinions about the only members of our government that serve for a lifetime. Our cast of characters includes real-life justices that we've painstakingly researched and presented in the game. Have you ever wanted to grab a coffee with Justice Ginsburg or argue about the Constitution with Chief Justice Roberts? Well, now you can!
In Supreme Courtship, you get to explore an idyllic Washington, D.C. and meet people in all roles of American politics. But not everything is as you might imagine. You have to deal with news reporters who try and sensationalize your views, bumbling and possibly corrupt officials, and you have to figure out how the judicial branch interlocks with the whole system.
So how can you get your hands on this justifiably jurisprudent game?
Well, as a two-person indie game team, there's a lot of work we need to put in to make this game a reality. And that work takes funding and support. Which is why we've launched a Kickstarter campaign along with a free playable demo to show America what a fun game about the Supreme Court looks like. And to get some help in making that game come to life.
Our campaign ends in less than a week, on March 16th. And we still need a bit of funding to get us over the finish line. That's where you come in. A $15 pledge will get you the game when it comes out, but even a single dollar or a share on social media is monumental in helping us reach our goal.
And have we mentioned our cool legal merch? Backers on Kickstarter can get awesome rewards, like a custom Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissent hoodie, or even an engraved gavel to let you bring the law down on anyone.
Making an entertaining game that teaches civics and the importance of the judicial branch is something that we're very passionate about. And if you believe in our mission, then consider checking us out on Kickstarter and spreading the word. You can find us on Kickstarter, Facebook, and Twitter by searching for Supreme Courtship. With your help, we can teach America about friendship, cooperation, and jurisprudence.
We'll now return you to Court Appointed. Thanks for your time, everyone.
All right, well, thanks for telling us all about it. Sounds like an interesting game because there's actually not many games out there that deal with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and we thought that a lot of our listeners are interested in legal things, so we just wanted to give them a chance to come on here and tell you all about it. So if it's something you're interested in, you'll know where to find it.
That's right. Check it out. So now after the whole Fatty Arbuckle debacle.
Fatty Arbuckle debacle.
Universal Studios decided.
It was a weighty matter.
Universal Studios decided to add a morals clause to the contracts. And so I was able to find the actual text of it, according to some research I did. It says the 1920 Universal Studios clause. The actor or actress agrees to conduct himself, herself, with due regard to public conventions and morals, and agrees that he or she will not do or commit anything tending to degrade him or her in society or bring him or her into public hatred, contempt, scorn, or ridicule, or tending to shock, insult, or offend the community, or outrage public morals or decency, or tending to the prejudice of the Universal Film Manufacturing Company or the motion picture industry. In the event the actor or actress violates any term or provision of this paragraph, then the Universal Film Manufacturing Company has the right to cancel and annul this contract by giving 5 days' notice to the actor or actress of its intention to do so. So,
Well, here's what I get out of that. While it lists a lot of things, it's not real specific. I mean, in other words, it gives you a lot of areas to interpret behavior falls under one of those categories.
Yeah.
But I mean, absolutely. You can't list everything. Who could even think of all the things that might happen to be able to list them? So you can't list specific things. So you just have to list enough scenarios where something you can say is the same as.
Now, the interesting thing is it says has the right to cancel and annul this contract. So if they just said just cancel it, that basically means that, okay, we're going to make a clean break. We're going to go separate ways. But if they annul it, that means like it never happened. So that means any money that may have been paid, you probably need to pay it back after that.
Yeah, or you might not get paid if they haven't paid you.
Oh, well, you definitely won't get paid if they haven't paid you. But I'm saying what they may have already paid you previously, they might demand it back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might have equitable arguments saying that, well, those are damages we suffered for you breaching this morality clause. They might say, well, under a theory of unjust enrichment, you know, I performed this work for you, so equitably, I should be allowed to keep this money. So, but that would be an argument you'd have to have. But it's interesting they use the word annul there because it seems to me they'd be trying to get everything back, mm-hmm. like the contract never even existed.
Well, you know, this Me Too movement brought out a whole lot of situations where that has occurred. You had the, what was his name, Matt Lauer on the Today Show. And then you had that, was it Les Moonves or Lee Moonves that was the president of, I think, CBS.
Mm-hmm.
And they both had, you know, been called out for sexual harassment and, you know, using their position of power with women and different under employees, you know, and things like that. And both of them ended up, they had like golden parachutes of like $61 million they were supposed to get. No matter whether they quit or got fired, they were supposed to get this money. And then the different, you know, companies that they worked for pulled out that contract detrimental clause, morality clause, and they didn't pay either one of them that money.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of money involved there.
Yeah, it's just crazy to me. I mean, if somebody is acting that way and the financial amount is not an incentive to do it, buddy, you got a problem. I mean, I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of money. Like, regardless of the fact if you are a good, true, and moral person, I mean, good Lord. I guess a creep's got to creep.
Well, but part of it is they say, you know, it says a question of when. Much of the recent damage has been caused not by acts during the contract period, but by acts many years earlier. So the opening bid from the counterparty is to have the morality clause apply based on when acts or allegations become public, not when they occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So the subject of the clause would obviously not be happy with this approach and would typically want the clause to apply only to conduct during the contract period.
Yeah.
And it says who? It says, I have had distributor clients burned by being obligated to pay for a film that became toxic because of bad behavior of an actor or producer on the film whom the distributor did not have a contract with. Thus, it is not enough to refer just to the conduct of a party to the contract. The counterparty now wants the clause to refer to anyone publicly associated with the film. Well, I was thinking of like when Kevin Spacey stuff came out.
Yeah.
There was some, I think, a film that they had to can and replace him because he was in it, and they were afraid that the film wouldn't go anywhere. And there's probably a lot of money involved in that.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, that's interesting, too, if you think about that, because when you're negotiating contracts, really what you're doing is you're trying to limit exposure and shift liability. That's kind of the whole thought process of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, whoever is going to be signing the morality clause wants it for any acts that occur during the morality clause, not that are basically that come to light during the contract.
Yeah, because if this happened before, like, say that the thing with Moonves happened while he was still a lower producer or something like that before he became the president, does that change things?
Yeah, or Matt Lauer before he could afford to install a button door lock on his desk.
While he was still a newscaster here in Huntington.
Was he here in Huntington?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He was a newscaster here in Huntington before he moved on.
Really?
Yeah, he was here for, it was only a year or two.
When was that?
Back in the early 80s, I believe.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Back when I was on Mr. Cartoon?
I think, yeah, could be. I think he was on WSAZ.
I didn't realize that.
The other thing that needs to be determined is who decides. There's a well-developed body of law on what constitutes an adequate investigation by an employer to fire someone for claims of sexual harassment, and that body of law could be incorporated as a standard by which the counterparty must make the determination. Even with such a standard, the subject typically does not want the counterparty to be able to make a unilateral determination and would prefer for determination of whether the clause has been triggered to be governed by arbitration or even litigation.
Yeah, the determination under the sexual harassment law is pretty well settled. It's what's called a subjective-objective test.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it does probably fit pretty well to this kind of issue. And basically, under a subjective-objective type analysis of this, you would basically say, is the moral act complained of immoral from the subjective viewpoint of the other party to the contract and a reasonable person's perspective outside the contract? So you basically have the person who is subjectively saying, yes, this is immoral and violating the contract, but is it also objectively immoral to a reasonable person? So you go back to that kind of reasonable person standard. So it's it's the two-pronged subjective-objective test from sexual harassment, because that's pretty much your standard sexual harassment test.
Yeah, you wouldn't want the people that, you know, if a company is trying to protect themselves and it benefits them to come up with the fact, oh, yeah, he did this, you wouldn't want them conducting the investigation so that they don't have to pay the $61 million.
Right.
You would want somebody independent to conduct that investigation, come to that determination.
Yeah, in their subjective opinion, it violated. That's what brings us to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but is it objectively offensive to somebody else, to a mm-hmm. reasonable person?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to rethink that timeline. I'd say Lauer was here, it was either late 80s or early 90s.
Oh, so a little bit later.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably when he was here. But he's there, you look it up. Google it.
I'm not Googling Matt Lauer.
Google Matt Lauer.
No, thank you.
You don't want that on your browser history, huh?
Let sleeping dogs lie.
He's a dog.
He is. Now, one of the first morals clauses for a professional athlete may have been in 1922, right after the Fatty Arbuckle incident. And this was another...
His brother Skinny Arbuckle?
This is another well-known, somewhat portly gentleman named Babe Ruth.
Yeah. Babe Ruth was known to carouse around and do some things.
He was. So his contract basically said this: it is understood and agreed by and between the parties hereto that the regulation as set forth above, numbered 2, shall be construed to mean, among other things, that the player shall at all times during the term of this contract and throughout the years 1922, 1923, and 1924, and the years 1925 and 1926, if this contract is renewed for such years, refrain and abstain entirely from the use of intoxicating liquors, and that he shall not, during the training and playing season, in each year stay up later than 1 o'clock a.m. on any day without permission and consent of the club's manager, and it is understood and agreed that if at any time during the period of this contract, whether in the playing season or not, the player shall indulge in intoxicating liquors or be guilty of any action or misbehavior which may render him unfit to perform the services by him hereunder, the club may cancel and terminate this contract and retain as the property of the club any sums of money withheld from the player's salary as above provided.
He didn't sign that, did he?
Yeah.
I can't believe it. They never enforced it.
He went to
from what I understand.
He went to bed early, and he could not drink intoxicating liquors.
Well, I don't believe that. For everything that I've read about him, they said that a lot of times he'd be out. He was a drinker and a carouser, and he would be out all night long and show up for some games never having gone to bed, and he'd still go out there and hit 3 or 4 home runs.
Well, let me show you something. It doesn't say anything about beer, and it doesn't say anything about 1 a.m. in what time zone.
Oh.
It's not 1 a.m. anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know what you're
it's 5
about.
O'clock somewhere.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
It may not be 1 o'clock, but it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
So if, you know, if Babe Ruth had a lawyer like me who could argue the finer points of contract interpretation.
That's true.
He may have been fine.
They probably didn't think globally in those days.
I'd say not. We were more of an isolationist type country back then.
But as you move forward through the different ones, there's lots of specific things that took place in contracts. Like Michael Jordan had one because they tried to put in stipulations, a lot of not just basketball players, but, you know, football players and athletes in general, they would participate and pick up basketball games.
Yeah.
And then they'd go and bust their ankle or their knee up or something like that. And basically the team they were with felt like they lost out because of that. So they put in clauses saying you can't play basketball. You can't play and pick up basketball games, you know, while you're under contract. Michael Jordan had a clause put in for the love of the game that he could participate because he loved the game.
Yeah, he said, I want to play basketball, and that's important to me. I'm going to play pickup basketball whenever I can, whatever I can do it. So,
and I'm Michael Jordan.
That's right.
And you're not.
That's right. I mean, it's...
And he could get away with that. Now, not everybody could. Now, you go on down the line, Dez Bryant.
Yeah.
He had a specific clause in his contract. that he was not allowed to go to strip clubs. He had a history of some problems going in strip clubs, so they wrote in his contract specifically he was not allowed to be in any strip clubs.
Yeah, that clause also said no alcohol. So it was no alcohol, no strip clubs, home by midnight. And evidently those rules are still in effect.
But then one of the ones that became popular, Kellen Winslow II, blew out his knee on a motorcycle in the off season. And so all the people, all the different teams started putting no motorcycle riding as a clause in most of their contracts they signed with their players after that.
Well, it's a good idea. I mean, if you have this money invested in somebody and you spend that much money on them, I mean, you don't want to pay them money where they're off joyriding on a motorcycle and hurt themselves.
Yeah, so. And that's not exactly morality, but they are dictating how you will behave and what you can do in your free time.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we want to talk about morality. We also want to talk about some of these kind of weirder contract clauses too.
Yeah.
So now I have a couple other ones I came across as far as weird contract clauses.
Yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson, basically, his contract that he likes to insert into his contracts is that when he's shooting movies, that he's always allowed to golf twice a week during movie shoots.
That's a good one. I'd put that in.
Yeah. So no matter how strenuous it is, you're going to give me some time to go out and get on the golf course.
Got to get 18 in.
That's right.
36.
Yeah.
Play
see,
twice.
See, exactly. It doesn't necessarily, the contract doesn't spell out how long he's going to be out there for. So
that's right.
You got to read between the lines. Dolph Lundgren. Mm-hmm. So remember him as the...
I remember him from the Rocky movies.
The Rocky movies. And evidently while he was making the 1987 movie Masters of the Universe, which is not a very good movie, he had a clause that gave him 3 chances to nail his dialogue before the studio hired someone else to dub his lines.
I think they did dub his lines in several movies because his accent was so overpowered.
Anyway, he made it. They didn't dub his lines in that movie. So, I mean, nobody saw the movie, but they didn't.
I'll be back.
I don't think that was him.
No, it wasn't him, but same problem.
Queen Latifah, she basically realized that she was dying too often in movies. And so she basically demanded that she have an anti-death clause in all of her contracts. Basically that, you know, you can't kill me off in this movie.
Well, how about you just read the script and see what happens to your character before you sign up?
Well, her explanation was, it's a smart business decision. If I die, I can't be in the sequel.
This is true.
That is true.
Well, that's an argument for the death penalty. If you kill them, they're not going to be a repeat offender.
That is true. I can't argue with that. Steve McQueen, when he was in the Towering Inferno with Paul Newman.
I remember that movie.
Yeah, that's a kind of a...
That's a classic.
That's one of the first kind of big blockbuster type movies that came out, wasn't it?
Yeah, before the Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah.
Same type thing.
And he demanded not only that he have top billing, but also the same exact pay as Newman and the exact number of lines. So he wanted it to be equal.
Equal, huh?
Yeah. Juliana
Margalis or whatever.
Yes.
Used to be on ER, and then she was on The Good Wife, was it?
Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
I can never say her name.
I think that's what it is, Margalis or something like
Margalis.
That.
Yeah, Margalis, mm-hmm. Yeah. She said, basically, on The Good Wife, that she wouldn't star in the drama unless she was allowed to wear a wig. Because the way the hair had to be done each time. So basically, they got a $10,000 wig, which she wore in all the episodes. So that was one of her stipulations. I'll do it, but I'm wearing a wig. Well, it better be a good wig.
I can understand that, because when you see all the work that's done on the hair, and they shoot it all different hours of the day and night, I guess. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you have to come in there for an hour or two before shooting
all the time. Get your hair done. Otherwise, you slap a wig on.
Roger Moore basically said
James Bond.
If he's going to play James Bond, he wanted a unlimited Monte Cristo cigars written into his contract. So basically, they just give him as many cigars as he wanted.
Well, I don't know. I would think that he would be in a position he could buy all the cigars he wanted anyway.
Yeah, you know, there's little extra perks.
I guess green M&Ms.
Now, here's one I thought was really interesting. There's a baseball player named Ray Slim Caldwell. And he was a Major League Baseball player, and he was picked up by the Cleveland Indians in 1919. And he was a really talented baseball player, but he had a reputation for being a really heavy drinker and a night owl. So before they took him on, they came up with a deal with him and put this into his contract. He was actually contractually obligated to get drunk after every game.
Mm-hmm.
Then he had to rest the next day, train the third, and pitch the fourth. So it was a regimented drinking contract.
I read that when I came across that one. That is what that says. I couldn't believe it. So he had to get drunk after the game he pitched.
Yeah.
So then they 2 days sober, and then he pitched, and then could get drunk.
That's right. And he ended up having a 5-1 record that season. So
didn't pitch many games.
Yeah.
Or didn't finish him anyway.
Maybe his stamina wasn't quite all that, depending on how drunk he got.
That reminds me of that old joke about the guy named Mel Famey that was a pitcher, and he liked to drink while he would pitch. And mm-hmm. one time he just imbibed too many, and he started walking in the winning run, and he was out there with the old Milwaukee can scattered around. And they said, "Look at that old bum out there pitching. And all that beer cans out there." And they said, "Hey, don't make fun of that. Don't make fun of that. That's the beer that made Mel Famey walk us."
Oh, man. That hit me late.
That's one of those thinkers.
Yeah.
You gotta think about it. Slow burn.
Yeah, it was a slow burn. I was thinking, wow, beer cans on the mound. That doesn't make any sense. What are you talking about?
It's the beer that made Mel Famey walk us.
Another baseball player, his name was, this episode's fraught with some really strange names here.
Starting with Heather.
Ossie Schreckengost. he basically made an unusual request before signing his new contract. He insisted that pitcher Rube Waddell not eat animal crackers in bed, because back then they didn't have as big a budget, so they would have to share beds when
they
travel.
Can you imagine that? Professional athletes having to sleep, not just sleep in the same room, but in the same bed.
And he was quoted as saying, well, we had to do that for our soccer road trips. But he was quoted as saying, "I didn't mind the flat cracker so much, but for a whole week last year, I woke up with elephant's tusks and corn horns sticking between my ribs."
So it was eating animal crackers. Yeah, I saw that one too. That was pretty bad.
And the last one is pretty much out of this world. Sunderland is a soccer team, and they signed someone named Stefan Schwartz in 1999. And they had noticed that one of Schwartz's advisors had booked a seat on the Virgin Galactic space flight to go into space. And they were concerned that he might want to tag along. So they insisted the player never leave Earth's atmosphere in his contract.
You can't go in a spaceship until after we're done with you.
That's right. I thought that was a pretty interesting one.
Yeah. Well, this is you know, like we talked about, these things started out, you know, more in entertainment business. And yes, sports is entertainment, but it kind of spread over into sports business and business. Now here's one that's become a little controversial, though. Are publishers, do they have the right to have a morality clause over writers that they're signed with? Because, you know, if you look back through history, there's a lot of writers that did some great writing, great books that they're known for, you know, famous things. These people's lives, their personal lives, were not anything to write home about, though.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was the one that I think it was Leonardo DiCaprio played, that Fear and Loathing in L.A. There was a writer that was based on a famous writer and how he did some of his stuff. And he was drunk and engaged with prostitutes and all kinds of other stuff that he engaged in.
You're talking about Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, he's a little crazy.
Yeah.
There's a video of Conan O'Brien shooting guns with him in a desert. I think it was Conan O'Brien. Anyway, he is crazy.
Well, yeah, him. I mean, even somebody like Ernest Hemingway, he was an excessive drunk, you know, but does that take away from his writings? Then, you know, like you were talking about, they could cancel or annul a contract. And then the company keeps all of Hemingway's earnings.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of treads on shaky ground, if you ask me, that because, you know, the book is one thing. Because the person, if they're controversial, does that mean you should keep their money?
Well, I think obviously, too. I mean, if you play this out in your head that the book has already been published and then something comes into play and then you say, okay, I want to annul this contract. That would basically mean you don't own that book anymore. And so then all the proceeds from that book would actually go directly to Hemingway. Mm-hmm. So if it's a super popular book, I doubt they'd want to annul it. They might want to try to have some sort of penalty in there saying that the sales were hurt based upon their actions. But probably not not just void the contract to begin with.
Well, there was a case, sexual harassment might be the most acute manifestation of this crisis, but is only one aspect of it. Last year, Simon & Schuster canceled a book by the right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you say it? You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
After comments he made about sex between men and younger boys, it put an abrupt end to tolerance of his controversialist views. Just months earlier, when the book deal was announced, human rights organizations had rallied to defend the firm's right to publish his autobiography, Dangerous, however objectionable his views were held to be. Canceling contracts is a costly and legally dangerous business for publishers, as the Yiannopoulos case revealed. It involved waving goodbye to a reported $250,000 advance, and Simon & Schuster only avoided being sued for breach of contract when the disgraced author opted to drop the lawsuit and self-publish instead. The fear among authors and agents is that the case will be seen to strengthen the argument for personal behavior to be written into author contracts.
Yeah, I'd read that Milo Yiannopoulos, he actually applied for a visa to go visit Australia, and it was actually denied based on character grounds. So
yeah, well, but the thing is, America was built on controversial people, and so to say, well, this person's controversial, so they violated their contract. I don't know that. Where do you draw the line? I mean, you could say in his day, Martin Luther King was controversial.
Yeah.
You know, when he would speak, what he would say was controversial. That doesn't mean it was bad, but there was probably a whole lot of people that I would even say more people that were outraged than were pleased with what he said.
Oh, no doubt.
Because of the time period and everything else. Now we see him as a revolutionary and somebody that opened people's eyes and led the charge to change, you know, civil rights and everything else to make equality what it is. Well, maybe it's not where it needs to be, but at least it's moved in the right direction.
Absolutely.
But, you know, so I don't know, when you get into somebody simply being controversial, is that enough to, you know, strike their contract?
Well, I think that's when you go back. Assuming it has very broad language that can not fit every kind of situation you might be able to imagine, you have to go back to that kind of subjective, objective standard, because
mm-hmm.
you basically have to say, essentially, is this objectively bad to a reasonable person? So I think that's kind of what you always got to come back to. It's not really a great test.
Yeah.
But it's, I think it's all we have.
The only other thing that I saw morality clauses going into was in cases of divorce proceedings. Now, there's sometimes in prenuptial agreements, you have clauses that will outline certain things like that,
mm-hmm.
that will favor one spouse over the other if certain things happen.
Well, you have a lot of times like extramarital affairs. That's the classic one.
Right.
So.
And so that's kind of the same thing as a morality clause.
It is. But, I mean, there are also morality clauses, which might be something less than an actual affair if
right.
something else happens.
Sure. Yeah. And it depends on how the contract's written or how it's interpreted.
Yeah.
And then you also have in family courts when people are getting separated or things like that, and then say that one of the spouses wants to say, well, look, she can't have any men over and spend the night while the kids are there because that wouldn't be right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a, you know, they're forcing family courts to then impose basically a morality clause on people. So.
Yeah. And, you know, as long as that goes both ways, I think that's easier for a family court to administer and say, do you, we both agree that as long as the kids are there, then we'll not have any strangers there. But you get into a slippery slope because at that point you say, unless it's approved by the other spouse. Well, okay. So the other spouse is going to approve this person.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, there is a kind of a...
I wouldn't even put that clause in. Hey, never going
to
happen.
No. I mean, all that does is ensure that the lawyers are going to get paid for years to come.
Yeah.
So they're going to keep fighting about that and keep hiring lawyers.
Yeah.
So
that's a hard thing to try to put something like that in the middle of.
Oh, no doubt. Morality, you know, that I don't think it has a good place in family court like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, people are just going to argue about that.
I would say.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy some different questions of different theories we discussed.
And I'm a theoretical guy.
You are a theoretical guy.
I'm hypothetical, too.
So, the first thing I'd like you to define, what is a clause?
Well, not Santa or commerce.
No.
It is, it's something that's written into a contract that is basically a rule that you have to follow or something like that, something that dictates behavior or an action that must occur or not occur.
Yeah, and contracts are basically made up of clauses, and they might have, there might be different kinds. Like, for example, a classic clause would be a choice of venue clause, saying that if there are any lawsuits as a result of this contract, then we agree that jurisdiction and venue would be proper in Cabell County, West Virginia.
Yeah, we have that in our storage contracts. Yeah. It says that if there's any litigation, it would be held in West Virginia. And we've had some of our larger customers that maybe are in Kentucky or Ohio or something, they send back our contract and say, we'd like this change to the state they're in.
Yeah.
So then I have the choice of saying, do I want to change this and get the business, or do I want to stick my head in the sand and say, no, we're not going to do it. So I usually change it.
Change it
and get the business. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, depending how where it is, I mean, it's not that far. It's probably not that big
right.
a hassle.
Well, and I'm hoping that I never have to go to litigation over anything anyway.
Yeah. Another common one was like an integration clause, which I think we talked about before. That basically says that the contract is a complete writing and understanding of all the different terms, and that anything that was said outside that's not integrated into the contract is not part of the contract.
Right.
So if there's some puffery going on where I promise you something, then but it's not in the contract, it's not in the contract.
And the only puffery going on is in Robert Kraft's massage parlor.
Now, in order for a contract to be legitimate, it has to have what?
It has to have a signature.
It has to have a signature. But this goes back to a contract theory we talked about a while ago.
The contract to be legal, it has to have an agreement.
An agreement.
A meeting of the minds.
A meeting of the minds, maybe. I said a peppercorn can be this.
It has to have something of value.
Close. You're getting warm. There's fire. There has to be adequate consideration.
Oh, okay.
Consideration. So, like, you're exchanging something.
Okay.
So, if somebody in these contracts for these morality clauses, somebody has to basically promise to adhere to whatever moral code the contract says. But in exchange for that, they have to be given something. They can't just be thrown in there all willy-nilly. So.
I see.
Yeah.
That made me think of something.
What's that?
I learned something this weekend watching an episode of Project Blue Book. Do you know that,
Is that how they write the legal citation guide?
What's that?
The Blue Book.
The legal citation guide?
Yeah, it's called the Blue Book. That's where you learn how to cite properly to all the different reporters. No,
Project Blue Book was that UFO project by the United States Air Force that started back in the late 50s, early 60s.
I must have missed that one.
There's been all kinds of shows about it. But anyway, you've heard of the group the Foo Fighters, right?
I have.
I always thought that was just a name they made up for themselves. Foo Fighters was what our Air Force pilots over Germany during World War II that saw UFOs, that was their term form, was Foo Fighters.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
I saw the Foo Fighters in concert.
Yeah?
Yeah, I saw them with Weezer.
I'm wondering if they knew that when they named their group Foo Fighters, if they knew where that came from.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
So. I thought that was interesting. I just thought it was a word they made up. They've been fighting Foo for over a decade.
Now, the final question.
All right.
What is the standard for sexual harassment that we were talking about would be very appropriate for the morality clauses?
Don't do it.
That's true.
You should not. Just don't.
You're going in the wrong direction. I'm going to bail you out.
Yeah.
It's the subjective objective standard.
Oh, okay. Subjective objective.
Yeah. If it's subjectively offensive to the person, the other side of the contract, and it would be objectively offensive to a reasonable person. So that's kind of taking that from a sexual harassment type case law. So basically for the sexual harassment type stuff, if it's subjectively offensive to the person who's being harassed and also objectively offensive to a reasonable person. So you just kind of take that and mash it up a little bit, and then you got your morality clause standard.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm glad you cut me off. I'd have probably offended someone with my answer. So
yeah, you weren't getting there.
No, so that was good that you jumped in when you did. But, the thing about these things is they are kind of broad.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't name everything that somebody might do because people are stupid. There's stuff they'll do that if it's like, John Grisham said, if I wrote this story as nonfiction, people would say, well, that's stupid. That would never happen. It did happen. And yeah. That's the way people are. People will surprise you. They'll do the stupidest stuff. So all you can do is write these broad things. And then when people do their stupid stuff, figure out which one of these broad things that it falls under.
Yeah, you're never going to be able to come up with all the stupidity that people are going to do.
Yeah, that's
true.
Leave
it broad.
All right, I'll remember that. The broader, the better.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out there, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.